Welcome, one and all, to another fantastic episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. As always, hosted by me, Brian J. Rowan, and joined by my two co-pilots. I don't know why co-pilots is the first thing that came to my head.
Flight.
We were just talking about the hilarious Captain Whit Whitaker Twitter feed. Holy God. Anyway, Danny King, a writer for The Film Stage.
Hey.
And Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage.
Hello.
Hello. We are here, as always, to talk to you about recent films and movie news. No news this week, though. I know that the Oscars just happened, but you know what? I'm sure that everyone's sick of hearing about them by now. And beyond that, and Obama kind of messing up the terminology of Star Trek and Star Wars, not a lot happening in the entertainment industry this week. So we're just going to avoid that. But we do have two reviews for you. The first will be Jack the Giant Slayer, the new film by Bryan Singer. And then the second will be an independent film that made Danny's top 20 list of last year and is currently on Amazon Watch Instant. And that is The Color Wheel, which is directed by Alex Ross Perry. Before we get into that, a couple of just notes about the show. You can find us on iTunes and subscribe to us. And if you do, that's pretty awesome because then you'll get us delivered straight to your iPod or iPad or computer without you even having to think about it. Which, as we all know, in this world of modern conveniences, is like the height of technology. You should also give us a comment, give us a rating, tell your friends, and if you'd like, you can send us an email at podcast@thefilmstage.com, and, we'll read it on the air, or we will address whatever shortcomings or good things you have to say about us. And I think that's about it. So, foregoing the usual movie discussion topic, I saw Jack the Giant Slayer last night, and, yeah, all right. So I think we can all agree, guys, that the marketing campaign for this did not leave expectations as high as they could have been.
The marketing campaign that started in December of 2011? You mean?
Yeah, the movie right. That has been coming out for years.
Right, yeah. The one that I saw a trailer for when I got back from the fourth Mission Impossible.
Precisely.
To put it into perspective, yeah.
Yeah, it used to be Jack the Giant Killer. Right.
Oh, okay.
It was, and then Warner Brothers felt that the word "killer" was too aggressive,
violence. Which is hilarious, given the level of violence in this movie.
Right. The change was to appeal to families, so that more of them would feel like they could take their children to see it. Parents right. would have more comfort.
So this is a 2-hour long movie, and I've suffered through some 2-hour long movies for this podcast. Dark Shadows comes to mind. So I wasn't particularly looking forward to this, and maybe it's a beneficiary of lowered expectations, but I actually kind of enjoyed this film. I'm gonna let a moment pass for that to sink in, because I'm sure people were looking for another Hobbit style rant from me.
No. Somehow I'm not at all surprised that you enjoyed this. I don't know why. I feel like I could sort of tell it was gonna be coming. So
okay, so you already had time to emotionally and spiritually prepare for it.
Yeah, I've already been disappointed in you.
So. Here's the thing. Okay, so obviously this isn't like a cinematic achievement on par with Tree of Life or Last Year at Marienbad, 2001. I mean, like there's so many better films out there, guys, that you could see. However, given the laziness that most people seem to attribute to large scale action films like this, I feel like this one does attempt and achieves a level of quality greater than like most studios would feel they need to give the audience. Does that make sense? So like I said, maybe it gains a little bit from lowered expectations, but like the story is not as rote and predictable as you'd think. The characters actually act in ways which are like advantageous to them as characters within a story and not just as a means to set up set pieces. Like, these are very simple things that shouldn't be impressing me in a film, but they do, and I enjoy that. And the romance between the protagonist and the princess is actually, like, steeped in some kind of emotional truth that, like, resonates throughout their childhoods. Like, it's not just, okay, well, here's a pretty guy and here's a pretty girl, and one of them has a sword and the other one's captured by giants, so obviously they're just going to fall in love. Like, there's actual there's a story behind it. There's actual romantic chemistry built up. And yeah, I don't know, man. I was sitting there and there's a interesting prologue that fills you in on the mythology of the giants in this world.
I've heard that's pretty terrible, just from an outsider's perspective.
No, and that's the thing. I was going to say, like, it is kind of terrible. The mythology is fine, whatever, but the they chose to shoot this prologue in the style of, like, woodcut dolls, but instead of doing, like, stop motion or anything, they just kind of do, like, a really, really, really cheap-looking CGI. And it takes you almost a while to figure out that they are supposed to be, like, dolls of wood instead of just, like, really shitty CGI. Which is weird because the reason that they're doing this is a kid is getting read to from a storybook, and the camera, like, swoops into the hand-drawn, like, lithograph? Like, in the book. And so I'm like, why don't they just animate this, like, two-dimensional? There's no reason for it to be suddenly, like, a doll, even though the kid is holding a doll. We're looking at the book. So there's just, like, this weird visual and narrative disharmony that was going on there. But once it got beyond that, and it actually got into the story, I was actually kind of taken in by it. And I didn't want to kill myself. Which is, again, like, incredibly low praise, but if you know how what my expectations were, and I think I did a pretty clear job of putting them out there, I mean, like, I was invested, and I wanted to see characters live. And the thing is that this isn't one of those films where you're just kind of like, ho-hum, like, the goofy troll beast is gonna come up and slobber against the wall, and then everything's gonna be fine. Like, no, the greatest thing that they did in this film was to actually make the giants threatening, angry, evil hell beasts that bite people's heads off with impunity. And the movie seems to think, and I guess the studio and the MPAA agrees, that if you are more than 20 yards back from a giant when it bites a person's head off, that does not count as obscene violence. It's like, well, it's not in a close-up, that's fine. You can't see the arterial spray, that's fine. Like, ridiculous. So many people get masticated in this movie. It's a little disconcerting. There were a lot of young children in the theater, and I think it's partly that you just forget what it's like to be a child that young. Like, I was concerned that one of them was going to start to, like, bawl and, you know, have to run out of the theater screaming. But no, they were all into it. So if you have young children and you're looking for a movie to go see, like, I think this is PG-13, right? It seems like it should be. I mean, part of me thought it should be R. But yeah, no, so it's PG-13. Yeah. But I mean, like, if you want to take, like, a 7 or 8-year-old, I think they're probably going to dig it. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know, guys.
No. Is that you talk about low praise and whatnot. I feel like saying a 7 or 8-year-old will enjoy it is low praise because 7 and 8-year-olds are dumb.
But yeah, I know. But so, like, here's my thing.
You know
when you're like a little kid and you see Star Wars for the first time and you enjoy it for a reason that's completely different than when you see it when you're older and you can appreciate kind of like the hero's journey.
Yeah.
Like, you want some rollicking action. You know, you want something that's going to engage you and, like, you're going to run out of the theater and pick up a stick and start swinging it, pretending it's a sword. You know? And it's not, right. And it's not, like, stupid, slapsticky, like, Transformers nonsense. Like, it bestows a little bit of wonder on you.
I suppose this probably won't hold up as well as the original Star Wars.
No, it obviously won't. But, I mean, but from what everyone seemed to be thinking about it, I feel like I should come to its defense. Like, it's not going to rock the world of cinema. It's not going to change the way we think about Bryan Singer as a director, either in the positive or the negative. But, you know, it was fun. And I think that, like, if you can bring yourself to, if you go in with not an expectation of, like, seeing the next greatest film ever, and you just realize that you're there for, you know, the cheap, fun thrill of seeing something impossible in a movie, and seeing it done well and committed to by a really strangely well-populated cast of actors, then you're gonna dig it. You're gonna be into it.
Yeah, I can't help but wonder why Bryan Singer was so interested in doing this story. It seems, I mean, yeah. It was fantasy and whatnot. It just, something about it feels very, from what I've seen, feels very workmanlike. And I'm not a huge Bryan Singer fan. I'm certainly not devoted to him as a filmmaker, but I do sort of like his work. And the whole thing just confuses me so much.
Yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense, in all honesty. And that's the thing, though. I think that he brings an earnestness and enough of a directorial touch to it. You know, he doesn't try to mask any deficiencies it may have just by making the camera spin around a lot. I mean, he gets the story. He tells it competently and directly, with an assurance that another more workmanlike director probably would not have had. And I think that it is just that earnestness that brings it a little bit above, you know, the run of the mill that we all thought it would be. I'm obviously not telling you that if you think it looks like shit that you have to see it because you're wrong, but I think that if you're on the fence about it, you know, you could be well served by giving it a chance. Also, just because I was talking about the cast, I mean, this has Nicholas Hoult, who was in the British TV show Skins and was recently in Warm Bodies and X-Men First Class. It's got Ewan McGregor, Stanley Tucci, Eddie Marson, who is a great character actor, Ewan Bremmer, so it's kind of like a mini Trainspotting get-together. I was really, I saw that, I was like, oh, sweet. And then Ian McShane, who we all know as Bill Swearengen from Deadwood. Al Swearengen from Deadwood. I don't know why I said Bill.
You know what?
Oh my God. I don't know, guys. I feel like this is going to be an episode kind of like, if anyone remembers when we talked about Cosmopolis, and I also talked briefly that day about Premium Rush, the bike messenger movie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I liked Premium Rush, but I was not a fan of Cosmopolis. I feel like this is going to be one of those days where people want to yank my my indie card from me, take away my art house cred, because yeah. We do have another movie coming up.
Did you ever have art house cred, though?
I think I did. No. I got called an elitist all the time in college. I feel like that's half the battle.
Where'd you go to college?
University of Maryland.
Okay. Well, some smart people there.
Yeah, we got none of it's art related though. That's the problem. So when
if you went to the university, if you went to like Tennessee or something, I'd be like, you know, I don't know. Our one Tennessee listener, the one person in Tennessee who has a computer, is going to be very upset.
Oh my God.
I should stop speaking probably and hand it over to you.
I was going to say, Nick doesn't speak for all of us.
Sounding like the guy from the color wheel. Just like
Jesus Christ. Yeah. All right. So I think I've said as much as I can say about Jack the Giant Slayer without getting into spoilers. And like, yeah, I don't know. I'll have a review up at my personal site if anyone wants a little more information. But not a bad movie. Check it out. I wish that my nephew lived closer so I could take him to see it because I think he'd dig it. And even though Nick thinks that children liking something destroys any artistic merit it may have, I happen to think that children should be entertained from time to time. Anyway, let's move on. Let's talk about The Color Wheel. This is a movie that came out in 2012, as I said, but it's now on Amazon Watch Instant. And it's directed by Alex Ross Perry, written by Carlin Altman and Alex Ross Perry, and starring Carlin Altman and Alex Ross Perry.
See a pattern here.
You have 9 new voice messages. First voice message.
Hi, Colin. It's your favorite sister, JR, calling. Give your sister a call back. I need your help this weekend, so give me a call.
Message erased.
I think we wanted to go down there and concentrate on the breeze and the pina coladas and not your emotional turmoil and your pathetic, shambled life.
You're such a jerk.
Okay, so The Color Wheel. This is an independent film about a brother and sister who go on a road trip to get the sister's belongings back from the college professor that she had been sleeping with slash living with and who has recently dumped her. And it sends them on to a spiritual and emotional journey that will take them to the brink of understanding themselves.
It makes it sound much more profound than it really is.
I know. I was kind of doing it facetiously.
No.
I don't mean to be a dick.
Yeah, actually thinking the opposite. I was like, you're actually saying something like really profound, but with like a completely unconvinced tone.
I feel like that's what it was going for. And so I'd like to put forward what the movie is attempting. And I mean, do you think that that is what it's attempting? Am I like misreading the intentions of this movie?
Yeah, a little bit. I think you're taking it as something that's a little bit more serious than it actually is.
Okay. Well, let's talk about our feelings about it, and then we can get into what we think it tried to be and what it ended up being. So, Danny, this was on your top 20 of last year, correct?
Certainly.
All right, so you kick us off. Give us a starting point from which to begin to dissect this thing.
All right. So, I know one of the things that impressed me the most was the visual style of the film, because I think you mentioned the word mumblecore earlier, and I feel like that has been tossed around in some reviews in terms of like these actors kind of reading their own dialogue and directing themselves and sort of bantering back and forth throughout the whole movie. But I think there's a kind of a very astute visual aesthetic to the film. It's shot in 16mm in black and white. So it's got a very grainy texture that I liked a lot. But I think even more importantly is that the camera is very disciplined, whereas in a lot of mumblecore movies, the camera is kind of hyperactive, zooming all over the place and sort of doing unnecessary things to try and amplify jokes or punchlines. And I think that watching the film a second time, the camera really rarely moves unless it's prompted to by a character. It's very kind of patient and steady while being handheld. And I think I really appreciated that throughout the whole movie, which is that the kind of the dialogue was balanced out by how sort of well accomplished the film was visually. And then on more of like a story screenplay level, without trying to get too spoilery this early, I think the movie sort of builds to an event that would normally seem kind of crazy, but I think the movie kind of consciously creates this world scene by scene where that feels like a completely normal ending to the story and a completely believable thing. And I think that's sort of like a really interesting accomplishment. And I think along the way, we spend a lot of valuable time with these people. And I think the insights into, you know, a lot of contemporary things like postgraduate life and things like that are very observant. So yeah, overall, I'm definitely a thumbs up.
Strongly disagree. But Nick, why don't you give us your read on it first before I kick into it.
All right, so you're about to get much more angry.
I'm not angry. It's no, because again, like, this movie didn't raise my ire like the Hobbit did. The Hobbit's gonna be my new metric for like anger. Like the Hobbit was a cynical, like, disgusting, just awful ploy for money, and this is a film that I believe was actually felt deeply by the creators, and I don't begrudge them, you know, that ambition. I just think that there were aspects of it that didn't land and that really torpedoed it for me. Okay, but yeah, that's me getting into my opinion, but we want to hear Nick's first.
Yeah.
Yeah, Nick.
So The Color Wheel, I've been hearing about it for almost 2 years now, because that's actually when it premiered, and there was some rumblings about this black and white mumblecore comedy, The Color Wheel, which, warming up people's loins a bit, and I wasn't so sure what it was until about a year ago when it started to come out and I saw more of it, and I wasn't quite sure how I was going to feel about it, just because I'm a pretty big mumblecore skeptic. It's just really not for me, let's put it that way. Yet I don't know if I'd even call this a mumblecore movie, mostly because it actually feels like a real movie, which I cannot say for some of the other entries into that wonderful little post-millennial subgenre. For one thing, as Danny mentioned, the movie has a really beautiful design. There's this 16mm photography, which is extremely grainy, and there's a roughness to it that I think feels more natural to its setting and its tone and its intention than the intentional rough design of many indie films. If you recall when we reviewed Beasts of the Southern Wild, that was probably my biggest sticking point, where I felt like there was something very self-conscious about that movie that I found entirely off-putting. Here, however, there's something that flows much more naturally. I think watching The Color Wheel, I felt like I was watching a construction that felt like almost a cross between this very deliberate, determined shot-by-shot basis, again, like a real movie, but there's also something very freeform of it that almost, weirdly enough, reminded me of a student film, which sounds like a knock, I know, and I use that as a knock against Wrong, of all movies, which is very different from The Color Wheel, just to listeners.
Nick, you're going crazy right now. First you were talking about like the roughness of the film, and I was like, but he hated that in Beasts of the Southern Wild. And now you're calling it a student film, and I was like, but wait, that's what he said about Wrong. You're like inverting everything. It's crazy.
When I say student film, I mean there's something sort of almost freeform about it. I think this 12 hours after the film has ended, I'm thinking about certain shots and certain editing choices, which are just kind of they're there, and they sort of spice up the proceedings a bit in a way that I wasn't entirely expecting. And it's something like that which I think makes Alex Ross Perry stand out as a director, but also as a writer with his co-star Carlin Altman. You know, they've written a screenplay that's very, very funny. But what's interesting is that it's funny in both this simple, crude way, but also at times this, I think, Woody Allen-esque playing with language, which I think is sort of the heart of the film, is language and interaction with people. And how would I put it? I feel like I should be careful what I say here, but there are times where Perry almost actually feels like a better constructor of scenes than Woody Allen. I don't want to get too far ahead of myself here. Okay. I think he does with dialogue and conversations and monologues that feels much more interesting and feels far more... There's a much more germane relationship between image and text here. And there's a... I'm going on too long. I'll let Brian take the...
I mean, you could finish that thought before you just relinquish.
Well, yeah, there's a texture to the movie. Okay. There was an atmosphere that I really, really loved.
Oh, boy.
I
don't know. I don't see a single thing that you all are talking about. Well, that's not true. I enjoyed the aesthetic of it. I liked what Nick talked about with the photography. Obviously, I didn't have a problem with Beasts of the Southern Wild, but I do agree also with Danny that one of the greatest hurdles for me in growing to appreciate the mumblecore movement as it is with like the Duplass brothers and Lynn Shelton is that kind of the frenetic camera and the weird tendency there is just to zoom in randomly or zoom out randomly. And I feel like it's a choice that's being made, but it's a choice without reason. And so that being, for my eyes, for that being lacking in this film was great to see, and I appreciated that. And so, yeah, that's good. I don't think the writing was that great. Sometimes it felt like there wasn't any writing. The amount of times that a character would begin to say one thing and then reverse and say another thing wasn't, to me, a construct of a character or like the writing. Like a David Mamet character will repeat something or change the way they're speaking randomly in the middle of a sentence to reflect actual human speech. This was like people who were either making stuff up and realized that what they were about to say didn't make any sense, or they flubbed a line and instead of taking a pause so they could just loop back and cut it, they just immediately reversed themselves and started speaking again. So that was a problem for me.
That happens to be the way I speak a lot, so there was something about it which felt very... believable.
And the funny thing is that I was watching and listening to the movie with the same ear that I use when I'm cutting this podcast, because I was thinking to myself, like, maybe this is just so real that seeing it in a film is kind of blowing my mind with the reality of it. But then I was like, no, I have seen documentaries, I have seen live interviews, I have seen videos of my friends speaking to one another, and I edit this fucking podcast every week. It's like a 3-hour long job to cut this 1-hour long podcast. And so I spend enough time around language that I feel like I would notice that if it happened as frequently as it does in this movie. And honestly, sometimes there was just this palpable discomfort with these actors in these situations speaking these lines. And it wasn't like the unpracticed kind of... like a Larry Clark film, if you've seen the movie Kids, or a Gus Van Sant film, if you've seen the film Paranoid Park. When those people are speaking to each other, it's stilted, but it's stilted because these are people who aren't performing per se. They're speaking like normal people talk to one another, especially younger people who haven't yet really worked out the cadence of a dramatic or purposeful, meaningful conversation. And these actors, it seemed like they half forgot their lines and were just kind of trying to pad and fill in. And it really continuously took me out of the movie. And that's not even getting on top of how grating these characters are. And not in like a fun, like, I'm invested in them kind of way, but literally, like, if I were forced to hang out with them, I would slap the shit out of them and walk away.
Oh.
And it's, again, it's that's the type of thing where I can be in a movie and dislike a character and yet still be invested in them somehow. But this movie didn't work that way for me. And there was a kind of repetition to everything that they kept saying. They kept reiterating the same ideas. This idea of, we haven't even talked about the plot since I first mentioned it, but JR wants to be, JR is the sister in this duo. She wants to be a broadcast journalist. I've never heard a movie that used the term broadcast or broadcast personality more. It's like she went to school for it and learned no other way to say it. And at the same time, you get this like speech like three different times from her brother about how her family is forcing her out. And I maybe it's just because we're trying to get the idea that she doesn't get it. She's not picking up on the very subtle clues that he's dropping every 20 minutes in a 5-minute long monologue. But I mean, like, I don't need to see that. He could just state that he has told her a million times and then tell her twice in the movie instead of continuing on with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's like an interesting aspect of the plot, is like this idea that she's been shunned from her family for kind of...
being a downer?
Well, mostly, I think, for like hooking up with this professor, and then I think she drops out of school, yeah. And then she breaks up with him. But I think one of the reasons he keeps repeating it to her is because she has this like almost like dorky quirk where she's kind of like oddly fun-loving and like in conversation. And so it's like she's not getting something about like her situation. And he's more of like a realist, at least at the start of the film. Like, he has this girlfriend that's pretty stable that he's been with for a while. I think he has like a stable, unexciting job, and she's different. And so I think he's just trying to kind of like hammer home that idea for her. And I think the fact that she doesn't get it is part of the intention.
And that's fine. And these are things that I actually kind of liked about the film. Like, I do like that the fact that you get the subtle idea that this is stuff that she has been told before and she's just not picking up on it. But I think the execution fails, and that is keeping me on the outside of it. It's the type of story that I could get behind. And even the crazy place, Danny, that you said it went to later, I mean, like, that's something I could get behind, but in this film, it didn't so much come out of nowhere as it came out of a place that it hadn't yet gotten to. Does that make sense? Was that just too, like...
I don't know. I feel like these are characters who live very stationary lives.
Yes.
And I don't necessarily expect them to change, because they're not the sort of people in real life who do change. They're very selfish and stupid and reckless. I don't... if there was some big epiphany, it would have felt...
I don't need the epiphany, though. Like, I don't want to... All right, so here, we've all seen Young Adult, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Did we all enjoy that film?
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
I feel like that's kind of the character. The person who is stuck and who... every aspect of their life is telling them to change already, but they just won't do it. But whereas that film created a character... And that's one of those selfish, annoying characters that I was really able to get behind. I think Charlize Theron did a great job with that, because you could see the reason for it. It wasn't just this person is an impetuous ass. It's this person is an impetuous ass because, and I don't think I got a because out of either of these people.
I don't know, because the movie starts almost in media res.
Yes, it does.
In a way. And there is, it is more a snapshot of their lives than an A to B story. Which, yeah, could raise the issue of characterization and believable motivations and the like, but I took it as it was, and because of that, I found that the depiction in that moment was very believable and affecting, too. I thought there was something very almost touching about the story of the sister, who is clearly the screw-up, who you see in these small moments is regretting her life decisions. And yes, there aren't big monologues. There aren't these grand statements about the state of her life. It is as it's presented, because the movie isn't trying to tug at your heartstrings. It's just trying to, again, be naturalistic, which I think it does very, very well.
I I don't know. I feel like I wasn't given enough about the characters to know. Like, okay, so here's something. The brother is very blunt with her about the ways in which she has screwed up her life. Like, from the first time that they really have a conversation about it, he is straight up cut to the bone, absolutely no sympathy whatsoever. And it's a little jarring to hear him talk to her that way, but you do tend, it comes to the point where you just kind of assume that he's told her this in 100 other ways and she's not getting it. But for some reason, I don't feel like that's actually happened. Like, these don't feel like lived in characters who've actually gone through this. It's like I'm reading a play onto the page and I have to just intuit what an actor would do with those lines. Which is weird because there is actually literally an actor speaking those lines to me.
Well, I think like part of the setup is that like these two people haven't seen each other for a while.
Yes.
I think.
I feel like
she's been shunned and then she kind of calls him up to help her move and he's surprised, I think.
Yeah, he seems to be.
And I think like they haven't. Like, it seems like when he's talking to her in that blunt way, it's almost as if he's been thinking about those conversations and he's been, like, thinking about where her life is headed for a long time. And this is maybe, like, actually one of the first times he's able to just, like, unleash that.
Okay. Yeah, and that's possible. But again, maybe it is just the deficiencies of the acting.
Yeah, I think that might be the biggest difference because I liked the acting a lot, and that I could see where that would...
Well, that's bananas. I don't understand that at all, Danny.
Whoa. Watch what you say about Carlin Altman.
Yeah, I think she's pretty
great. She was very hit and miss for me. Like, scene to scene and almost sometimes within scenes.
I feel like what I liked most about her performance is just how she played up that, like, awkward dorkiness where she would be, like, like there's a scene where she runs into a newswoman and she starts off trying to act really professional. And after like 10 words, she tries to get through the scene by acting really silly and playful. But it's clear that she's just like not very intelligent or like knowledgeable about the situation she's in. And I think like that's kind of a like daring thing for an actress to emphasize is just kind of like how oblivious her character is. And like, maybe even, like I said, like unintelligent in some ways.
Yeah. And, you didn't find, Colin funny at all? Brian?
He was like a really low rent version of that guy in, the guy that you like in Girls who was in Alex Sleepwalk with Me. Yeah.
I think they're very different because Colin is more manic and more of a loser and a bit crazier. His first scene where he's talking to his girlfriend and he's saying,
so awkward and forced. Like there was,
in his dorky voice, come on, I'm trying to make it erotic for you. No.
Oh, I was sitting there with my like that being like my first initiation into this film's world and its act, like its characters and its dialogue. I was like, oh, I'm gonna hate this.
Also, when he said, come on, I've got this I've got this aroused black man sized erection for you right now.
Oh god.
Oh, it's so, oh come on.
It's just like it was funny, but that was like a brutal
line. No, I'm saying to Brian, this is gold. This is
gold?
Yeah.
I don't believe it is. I do not concur with your assessment, sir. Yeah, I don't know. I really don't know. Because again, there are parts of it where I'm thinking about like, okay, once these people have had like a couple of months of rehearsal and once they've really figured out who their characters are, maybe this could be a good film. But then I'm like, oh wait, they've already made this and I'm watching it right now. Like it's not ready, it's not complete. I don't think these are the right people for it. Carlin Altman excluded for the couple of scenes that she's good in. Like, I wasn't in it, man.
I think his name is Bob Byington, if I'm pronouncing it right. I thought he was perfect as the professor.
Oh my god, no he wasn't.
I thought he was like, that okay. Scene was so harsh.
Here's another thing. I was a journalism major, so I had a lot of journalism professors. not a single one of them would have lounged around in a tastefully appointed, like, midtown apartment, drinking wine out of a crystal glass and speaking. I mean, I feel like this the person who created this movie, for some reason, they had originally written this person as, like, a poetry or English lit professor. And then they were like, you know what? That's lame. Let's just change it to journalism, but keep everything else the same.
Yeah, I watched this movie with a friend of mine, and afterward she said, so was the journalism professor supposed to be blatantly gay?
Which I thought, too. Yeah, I was like,
which I thought was sort of an interesting choice, at least. It was a bit distracting. I will give you that. The stuff with the professor felt a little incongruous to what else the movie was doing. That felt a little too conventional to me.
But my other problem with that scene is it's a perfect representation of my issue with the film. Like, her and the professor have this speech to each other, and she's like giving him shit and saying that he never like took care of her and that everything was awful. And then he's saying that like she's a child and he just wants to have like one good memory of her. Again, in a way that's either like faux intellectual or just completely uninvested. And then she says she has to go to the bathroom, and then she comes back, and then they just have the same argument again.
Yeah.
right. I don't know. Thing. I guess I don't really mind that because it's what I said. They're stationary people. This is the way they
And that's they fine, but it just seems like that was obviously like just a cutaway pad in, and then let's just do it again for time. I don't know. And like again, I could get the concept of them being stationary people without having to actually like invest them with some history, and I'll be fine with it. But don't just have them repeat things constantly. I feel like we're getting caught up in this though. We should probably get into the end of the film because that's where as Danny primed us for earlier, it gets kind of crazy. So let's go into spoilers. Before we do that, I'm assuming that both of you recommend this film to anyone who's interested.
Yeah, if you're interested, but this movie is certainly not for everybody.
No. I'm going to do something weird. I didn't enjoy this film, but I understand how it could be enjoyable, and I feel as though the director and Carlin Altman do have futures, and so that this would be an interesting kind of glance at them at a formative stage, and it gives you a view of potential in the making. So I'm actually going to say, yeah, if you're interested, you should check it out. How's that for blowing your minds? Again, I dislike this film, but it's in a very academic way. And it's so close to being something that I would probably have liked that I'm a little, I think I'm even more frustrated with it because of that. But let's get into the end, because that's where it kind of flew off the rails for me. They go to a party after collecting her stuff, and it's a bunch of friends from high school. And this, I guess, is just another thing. So the I'm trying to work out the migratory patterns of this family, because the guy, the brother, Colin, is living off in the suburbs with his parents. The sister is 2 days drive away in, I guess, their old hometown, going to college because they run into high school friends there. Or did the high school friends just randomly happen to be living there now too?
Because no, that was, I took it as that was their hometown.
Okay, because so she went to college in their hometown. The parents moved away and took Colin with them. And the grandparents have a random cabin like an hour away from where they used to live. Right? Anyway, not important. It's just something that kind of I was like working out the logic in my head and I was having trouble with it. But so they go to this party. One of the strangest, most awkward experiences that I've ever had to endure in a film vicariously.
He walks in and the guy pours the wine down his shirt.
Okay, no. All right. So that was actually kind of funny to me. I don't know why, but just the guy is so adept at acting like an asshole. Like he's just like, "Oh no." And then he's like trying to like wipe it off with his bare hand just like smearing it into his shirt. Like what? Mm-hmm. Who? In what world? I don't know. But yeah, I enjoyed that. I don't know why Colin had a pineapple.
Well, it did lead to a great conversation with a woman. And yeah. Also, you know, afterward he says, I'm just going to stand here cutting up and eating the pineapple. Which I love it. I love that.
Oh, Nick. All right. I mean, that's fine. I mean, I'm probably the only person who thinks this. There's a show called Psych on USA, and they try to get a pineapple into every episode. So I just was like, oh, that's the pineapple.
Don't mention that show.
Not a fan. More of a fan of The Mentalist.
I don't watch either because I respect myself.
Okay. Anyway.
Okay. Now that you've sucked the air out of the room.
So this is the party that, like, is the symbolism party from hell. There's literally a scene where people are asking JR what she does, and, like, three different people say that if she doesn't do anything, she's lame.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's cool with everyone? Everyone's fine with that? I feel like the awkward pauses and the confused looks on their face should have been enough. We didn't actually need other speaking characters to say, well, it's not like you just sit around doing nothing all day. That would be stupid.
Yeah, okay.
Is she so stupid that she couldn't just say, office? I work in an office.
I don't know.
Is that how stupid her character is?
I mean, I think every other person in the room is just like a really mean person.
They're all terrible.
Yeah, people. So they're going to pick on her.
Including the wheelchair guy.
He's horrendous.
You know, wheelchair people are the worst kind of people.
Well, no.
They think their wheelchair insulates them against
if judgment. Did you watch? You know what happens with him.
Yes, I do.
Come on. Don't play that.
I'm not playing that. I was just making a joke about wheelchair people. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Oh, okay.
That wasn't, like, specific to the movie. Anyway, let's go on. So, Danny, you were saying...
Yeah, well, no, I mean, the first part is, like, everyone else there is really mean. And then the other part is she's so, like, invested in creating this image for herself that she can't help but just look like an idiot. Like, she tries to... rehearse like a news story for them, and she completely messes up like five or six words into it multiple times. And like, I think that's just part of her insecurity. And then when they ask her what she does, she can't come up with anything, and then she tries to think too hard, and then she just ends up looking silly again.
All right. I just she's such a dysfunctional human being that it's difficult for me to even begin to comprehend her existence.
But it's like she's dysfunctional, but you could understand it based on the situation.
But what, like, is the situation? She's just a crap person.
Well, I mean, in that specific scene, she's with all these people she went to high school with, and she's been telling everyone that she has these great jobs lined up and these offers.
But, like, what is the genesis of her, I don't want to say laziness, where does this come from? Who is she? How did she become this way? Childhood. Like, is it just her as a person?
No, I think it's pretty clear because she was at school and then she fell in love with this professor. She threw away everything for him, and then the relationship went sour. It's not at all a complex development. It's pretty clear.
No, but like, we get images from her childhood that she has never been an ambitious or a worthwhile human being. Like,
right, because, well, I mean, there are plenty of... I'm in college. There are plenty of unworthwhile human beings who go to college. I can tell you.
But what I'm saying is, like, why? Like, what is she... Is she just, at her basics, nature versus nurture, nature full out one? She was never, ever, ever going to amount to anything?
Mm.
Like, usually... Like, let's look at Jeff Who Lives at Home. Have we all seen that film?
No.
I saw that.
Okay. Danny, this is more for you then. But I'm not going to get into spoilers, so it doesn't matter. But that movie features a character who is a shut-in, lives in his mother's basement, just waste of a life that doesn't do anything. He watches Signs all the time and is waiting for images from the universe to show him what to do. He doesn't attempt to achieve anything for himself. In that way, he is very much like JR. He sits around waiting for it to happen. But we get a reason later on that ties into his character and actually influences a lot of what we've seen that explains that. So Jeff is a victim of history and a composite human being of a series of events that have led to the type of personality that he has. JR appears to just be a piece of shit. If that is what I'm supposed to get from her, then the movie succeeded.
But she's not a piece of shit. She's dumb and naive, but she's not necessarily a bad person. I think the movie goes to... I think the movie and Carlin Altman go to efforts to show that she is not a bad human being. She's just not a particularly wise one.
She's just lacking in all manner of ambition or knowledge or...
Yeah.
She's like empty. She's completely empty.
She's not completely empty. She's confused and she's wayward.
You are so generous, Nick Newman. Okay. I never thought that we'd get more compassion for a character from you than from me.
Mm.
I don't know. All right, so I feel like we're at an impasse on that. So let's go to the climactic moment of this film. They go to their grandparents' house after having been at this party from hell. And they are kind of hanging out and talking about how much better they are than everyone else because they're not fails. I think that's a direct quote. And they talk about this idea of being a teacher, and apparently Colin has spoken out against this concept of being a teacher to the point that JR had actually like entertained the idea but then let it slip. And then she goes on to this long monologue about the type of romance that he would enter into with one of his students. Apparently very well thought out. I'm basically assuming that that is a reflection of how her relationship with her teacher went. Anyone want to pick up what happens next?
Well, few things.
Yes.
One of the things I really liked about this movie the first time I saw it was that I wasn't surprised when they start making out. It felt like the next step of this story. And then the second time I saw it, you really see specifically how he's kind of laying that structure in with every scene. I mean, one of the first scenes we see them together, they are like forced into pretending to be a married couple by this creepy motel owner. Mm. And that's a really funny scene, I thought. And at the time you think, all right, this is like a harmless scene. They're like, they have to kiss each other. So there's another scene in the gas station where she like changes her shirt and he's kind of in there with her. So that kind of even underlines it further. Then she walks in on him on the party when he's making out with another girl. And there are just so many moments during the film where it feels like they are attracted to each other in this way that almost like goes beyond a sibling dynamic.
It's very, very uncomfortable.
Yeah, and I thought that was just like kind of an amazing accomplishment to lead up to this 10-minute shot where two siblings like make love and it feels like a totally real thing. And that was one of the reasons why like her dialogue during that kind of climactic scene where she's talking about the professor and she's talking about all these other things, it almost just felt like filler intentionally. Like, I don't even know if I was listening to the dialogue as intensely as I was watching the camera kind of move in slower and slower on them and just looking at their body language. Like, they're clearly gonna start kissing in a matter of moments. It's just a matter of when. And like, I just can't remember like another scene when I was like, when I just like felt that kind of dynamic. I thought it was just pretty special.
Mm. Doesn't hurt that the writing in the scene is actually very poignant too.
Yeah, it's very good. But it goes back to that idea that the movie's kind of as astute visually as it is on the page.
Right, and it's exactly what I said. It's that relationship between text and image that Perry is clearly so adept at displaying here. And it's what makes, again, it's what makes The Color Wheel more than just another bullshit Fox Searchlight mumblecore, look at this indie aesthetic that we've got going on here type of thing. It's what makes it feel like, I actually tweeted last night that I feel like this could be a sign of redemption for independent American film. I'm not saying that this itself is the redemption, but it's movies like this and people like Alex Ross Perry that I think could help make that category interesting again and worthwhile. And it's scenes like that which I think perfectly show it.
So coming to Blu-ray...
That's it? You're done?
I don't even know where to begin.
Come on, bro.
Having people see each other in various states of undress does not qualify as building a relationship. These two people felt like strangers the entire movie. And, like, I put that up to the idea that, you know, they're brother and sister, but they become really alienated from each other. But the second that you launch into a sudden jarring scene of them making out, I just, like, it No, it just doesn't work. I've seen this type of thing play out before in film, in books. Like, I'm not just like, oh, that's nonsense, that wouldn't happen. Like, for these characters that I've been watching, it does not feel real that that should have occurred. There has been not a single moment of shared affection between them, aside from, like, him falling to the ground for, like, the third time and her pressing a damp cloth to his head. And it just, like, it... No, it just doesn't work. It just doesn't make any sense. There's nothing... I cannot see the things that you two saw that justify this. And again, it's like I can see what they were going for, and I can see a version of this film in which that would have worked, but I don't have that version. I have this version, and in this version, there is far too much animosity between them. There is never a moment of any kind of bonding outside of that one scene, and it's only because they've found a new group of people to hate to, for a moment, put away their hatred of each other.
But I think, like, animosity is, like, can be part of an attraction because it's, like, such an intense feeling. Like, it would be different if they were just bored with each other. But they're clearly not, because
they... But he is, like, bored of her. He's bored of
how impossible
it is to get through to her.
I think he's more frustrated in, like, a way that keeps him engaged and, like, fighting with her. I see the two of them as very, like, charged when they're with each other in a way that definitely has, like, elements of anger.
No, but see, what you're describing to me is the relationship between Brandon and Sissy in Shame. Like, if they had started making out at any point during that movie, I would have been like, okay, that makes sense. In this film, it was two people who just were, like, in different rooms insulting each other the whole time. It rarely felt like they were even inhabiting the same space. There was no reaction to the other one's presence. And so to then finally put them into a situation of proximity, and it was just so clearly building up to it that it hadn't earned it, that I was upset when it went there just because it felt like it thought that it had and it hadn't, and it annoyed me that it thought that it had. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's just like...
Again, it goes back to... Yeah, you all were more on the side of this movie and were with it. So it makes sense that since you were getting from it the things that I thought that I should have been, that you'd be fine with it.
Yeah, I mean, I interpreted that animosity, like, so differently, which is interesting.
No, see, all I got from him was this kind of, like dismissiveness, this, like when you have to be around someone because they're, like, because they're part of your family and you don't like them and you don't hate them for, like, various passionate reasons. It's just, this is a person who's in my life and I cannot wait for them to be gone. Like, he was just frustrated and upset with her because she's a child that has to be looked after. And it's not like he has a paternal streak that he's kind of, like, appreciating and enjoying having to be the one that takes care of her. He just seems to openly disdain her on a very passive, unengaged level, on the same level that he treats literally everyone else in the movie. And so... It didn't work for me.
Damn it.
But again,
yeah, well, fuck you. How about that?
Again, though, I mean, like, it's not me going, like, just, ah, fuck this movie. Like, I see it, I understand it. It just doesn't work. And hopefully I'm doing a good enough job of expressing why it doesn't work to me in a way that goes beyond just screaming at the sky. Any final thoughts, any final instances in this movie? Do we want to talk about the half-second shot of the door opening that comes right before the credits?
Any thoughts on the title?
The Color Wheel?
Yeah.
I thought it was ironic because it's in black and white.
Yeah.
I also think it's sort of the gamut of emotions that the movie runs to. And there is sort of an irony there how the film is in this very, not just black and white, but it's very harsh black and white, and they're not just running a gamut of emotions, but a very rough one at that.
I see.
I think it's an interesting choice.
Yes. Again, so again, it's weird because even though I've said all this stuff and how much it didn't work for me, I feel like it's a first draft of something that could have been good, and I hope to see better works from all involved later. So check it out. I feel really odd right now.
Well, Perry has a an HBO series coming, so.
Oh, Jesus.
Just like
Lena Dunham, my favorite
person. Just like
person.
Lena. That's right.
Oh, my God. Not a fan. Still haven't watched the second season of Girls.
Yeah.
I'm debating whether or not I should, just because it's like, if I don't like it, then I'm going to have to deal with it.
Yeah, don't.
I don't know. I do like Donald Glover, though. Anyway.
Well, he's in for 2 episodes. So.
Yeah. Well, I could watch those, too, and then that would give me a barometer to work with, you know. Anyway. I think that brings us to an end. Good conversation, one and all. Check out The Color Wheel on Amazon Instant Video. It's like, I don't remember how much I paid for it. This is the problem with being able to just click something.
It's only $5 for a week-long rental in HD.
Yeah. Okay, so that's how much it was. All right, yeah, because I just clicked the thing, and I was like, maybe I should have looked at the price. Amazon one-click purchasing is a devious and ingenious creation. But yeah, coming to Blu-ray and DVD, we have Schindler's List, the 20th anniversary limited edition.
Yeah, boy.
Good film.
Hell yeah. We have Wreck-It Ralph, which I didn't see. Did any of you see it?
I saw Wreck-It.
I was kind of curious.
I think the first half hour is great, and the last hour is just good.
Okay, sweet.
So it's good.
Yeah, check it out. Check out Wreck-It Ralph. We also have Westworld coming to Blu-ray. The Intouchables, which was a movie that got some good notices last year. Playing for Keeps and Lay the Favorite, which I heard nothing good about.
Oh, my God. What a fucking nightmare of a double feature that is.
The greatest thing is that the DVD covers look as though they were designed by the same man.
It's the same font, actually.
It is the same font. Not only the same font, but they have that weird thing that people are doing now where it's just like all the main characters in boxes on like gradient color backgrounds.
Catherine Zeta-Jones is in both on both covers.
She's been busy lately.
Yeah, I didn't even realize that she was in. It's kind of funny because thinking back to Side Effects, I said, man, I haven't seen her in a while. This is awesome. And this is why I haven't seen her, because she's in stuff like that. Yeah. If anyone is into the Ravens, there's a Super Bowl champions thing coming out. I don't know, it's here. But I will also say that Buster Keaton's College is coming out, and the remake of Red Dawn, which was awful, just completely awful. I had to see that, and I still haven't forgiven people. But yeah, anything I didn't say that we want to give a shout out to?
Kind of The Marine 3 Homefront. Now, no, this is a pretty bad week. There's something called Touch of Love 3D, which I'm pretty sure is porn.
It does appear to be porn.
Is this like 3D Sex and Zen? You guys remember that? It was the Chinese movie that outgrossed Avatar.
Yeah, I do remember that. Yeah.
So the full title is Touch of Love, the Intimate Yoni and Lingam Massage.
I like how they're just using like lens flare to...
Oh wow! I'm looking at the Amazon description. This is definitely porn. Wait. Oh, what is this? It's like an instructional video for genital massaging or something.
Okay. Anyway,
and it's in 3D. What the hell?
Moving on. Also, Cowgirls and Cow. I want to say this correctly. Cowgirls N Angels.
Is that also porn?
I don't believe so. It does look like it has James Cromwell in it, though.
It could still be.
It could still be porn. Starring Haley Madison and James Cromwell.
Wow.
Anyway, moving on. Coming to theaters March 8th, we have Oz the Great and Powerful, the newest film by Sam Raimi, who of course did Evil Dead, Drag Me to Hell, and the Spider-Man films.
For Love of the Game.
For Love of the Game.
It's a good movie.
Yeah. This stars James Franco, Michelle Williams, Rachel Weisz, and Mila Kunis, so... I don't know.
I'm looking forward to it. I'm really... I love Sam Raimi. I do, and...
I love Rachel Weisz and Mila Kunis, so...
Right, and I feel... the trailer's a little underwhelming. It looks a little too Alice in Wonderland-y, but I think that Raimi is a far better filmmaker than Tim Burton, I'm going to put my trust in him. And, I mean, I'll save this for next week, but... Yeah, Raimi's got a special place in my film watching heart. Oh. So I am looking forward to it. And I've heard some early good things.
Flinty, dark film watching heart.
Yes.
Yeah, no, after having been pleasantly surprised by Jack the Giant Slayer, I'm not as down on Oz the Great and Powerful as I had been. I think Jack is going to be one of those films that kind of teaches me to judge a book by its cover. Not to judge a book by its cover or a movie by its poster, because neither of these have great posters. We also have Dead Man Down, starring Colin Farrell and Noomi Rapace, as well as Terrence Howard. That is by Niels Arden Oplev, the director of the original Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. It's got a fantastic trailer. I've heard nothing about it, but Nick apparently has some sources that say that it might not be as good, but I'm still excited.
The trailer is interesting because it uses a sort of a jazzy cover of Pink Floyd's Shine On You Crazy Diamond.
I love the cover that's in that trailer.
Which I had not seen the trailer until I was in a theater and I heard the song playing, the instrumental, was thinking, why does this sound so familiar?
Right.
Yeah. And then suddenly I hear the singing and I go, oh, what the hell? This is not what I was expecting.
Yeah. But
so, you know, even if the movie's bad, we'll have a nice trailer.
Yes. we'll always have the trailer. We also have Beyond the Hills, which is by the director of 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, and The ABCs of Death, as well as Don't Stop Believin', Every Man's Journey, and The Silence, which I've never heard of. Anyway, yeah, so guys, what are we thinking? Oz the Great and Powerful, probably the best?
I saw Beyond the Hills at the New York Film Festival.
What'd you think
of it? I'll probably be seeing it again. I liked it a lot. It's no 4 months, but I mean, like, that means anything because that movie's pretty incredible. So yeah, definitely right. Check that out.
Yeah, I definitely want to see Beyond the Hills. And
I thought that I'd heard that it wasn't as good.
Interesting. Good. It's another. It feels like Someone in Love to me in terms of it was divisively received at Cannes, but as more people have seen it, it feels like the consensus is sort of formed that it's still a very good movie.
Okay. Yeah, because
so you'll probably
reaction.
See more positive reviews come out.
Yeah, because I remember the reaction coming out of Cannes not being that great. So, okay, Danny is pimping Beyond the Hills, and Nick says Oz the Great and Powerful, and I'm going to say Dead Man Down. So really, can't go wrong with any of them. No thoughts on any of the other ones. That is it. Let's give our random recommendations before we sign off. Nick, let's start with you.
I'm going to break policy this week, and I am going to actually recommend a rewatch.
What?
Don't believe it. I know.
Oh, wow.
This is fucking crazy.
I'm only going to recommend a rewatch because this is a movie that I have changed my opinion on quite strongly, and also one that kind of felt like watching it for the first time. Last week, and that is Michael Mann's Miami Vice from 2006.
Yeah, Miami Vice.
Ooh.
I fucking love that movie, guys.
I had not seen this since 2009, right before Public Enemies came out, and I had I was not a fan at all. I remember finding it very stilted and forced, and weirdly enough, this will sound strange to people who haven't seen it, but my reaction to it was actually kind of like your reaction to The Color Wheel, Brian. Funny enough, and. What I did was I saw on Twitter people were aflutter with talk of a UK Blu-ray that included the theatrical cut of the movie, which is widely considered to be superior to the director's edition.
That is correct.
So I decided, yeah, I bought the Blu-ray from the UK and it arrived, and I watched it on a big screen with some sound speakers. I found a place to do that, and I'm glad I did because it's. The film is more of an experience than it is a tradition. It's not, you know, at all a traditional narrative. It is very much, it's more a character piece, and it's also this weird look at shifting identity. And like The Game, which I also re-saw recently, it's a great study of acting, too, which was surprising. That's kind of what the movie is about to me, is acting and perception and identity. Which is a very Mannian theme, but I think that this is probably the most pure distillation of that. So if you are a Michael Mann fan, and I don't know, maybe you haven't seen Miami Vice in a while, and you want to give it another shot, do it, because I'm glad I did, and it's great not to have that sort of that millstone around his career anymore. Also, the digital cinematography I'm a huge fan of. I know that it's funny, we just talked about the color wheel with its 16mm, which I loved, but this is also great too. And I, there are a few filmmakers, if any, whose use of digital I approve of as widely as Michael Mann, who just goes full, who goes all out with it. He embraces it and he lets it be smeary and strange and colorful and vibrant. So on Blu-ray, it's quite nice.
Yeah, I'm 100% behind that, because I saw that in theaters and I was like one of the few people who out and out loved it immediately. And I'm glad that actually some people are starting to come over to my end of the things.
Yeah, there's been a big shift in the past couple of years that's been fascinating to watch.
Yeah, I'm glad. I'm glad because I enjoyed the hell out of that film. And yeah, especially like the cinematography and the acting and just the tone of it. And
yeah,
great, awesome. So Danny, what about yourself?
Well, I caught a pretty cool double feature at the Anthology Film Archives this week in New York City. And there were two films by this American director named Dan Salit. And I hadn't heard of him since a couple of weeks ago. He has a new film coming out called The Unspeakable Act, which has been getting really good reviews. I know, I'm pretty sure Peter Labuza is a big fan of it, who guested here a couple of weeks ago. And yeah, and so Anthology was showing this director's two previous films there. They're called Honeymoon and All the Ships at Sea. And they were intriguing to watch back-to-back because Honeymoon, like Color Wheel, is on 16mm, so it was fantastic to look at. And then All the Ships at Sea was in digital video, and it was shot in 2002, so it was a very kind of early form of that technology. And the first 10 minutes of watching it were almost, it was almost as jarring as like the first 10 minutes of The Hobbit in 48 frames per second. The image just looked really kind of cheap. And I just think it's just this kind of a sign of how much the technology has grown since then and how quickly it's grown. But outside of that, both movies are really good. And, you know, I guess his name, Dan Salit's, kind of relevant in terms of this talk of American independent cinema, because his films certainly haven't caught on to the mainstream, although his new one might change that a little bit. And he's certainly not working within mumblecore or any kind of definitive independent style. He's kind of just doing his own thing. And it's interesting to see that develop. He was also a critic before he started making movies. And he just seems kind of like a really genuine, like cinephile turned sort of filmmaker, because he doesn't care if his movies make money. I don't know anyone who's seen like any of his films almost. And so it'd be interesting to see if his name kind of grows over the coming months and whatnot.
Yeah. And I plan to watch the first two on Amazon Instant Video soon. So
are they already on there?
Yeah.
I may have to check that out.
And I know I was talking to Peter on Twitter, and he actually said the digital image of All the Ships at Sea didn't look as bad as on his computer, which is interesting. I guess it'll look worse if it's blown up.
Okay.
But I mean, that's just kind of funny. Like, you might think it looks better than me, and I saw it on a big screen.
All right. Well, yeah, my recommendation. It's a documentary, actually, and it is called The Bridge. Has anyone heard of this?
Oh, yeah, I've heard of it. I haven't seen it.
No, I don't believe I have.
Oh, well, look at that. This is a film documentary by Eric Steele, who, under the guise of filming weather patterns around the Golden Gate Bridge, actually filmed a number of suicides.
Oh, God. I've heard about this. Yeah.
Yes. And it was the type of thing where the people watching the cameras, it would only be on during daylight hours. And anytime they saw someone who appeared as though they were going to jump, they would alert the police, but you know, you can only get out there so fast. And so there's a number of failed attempts and a number of successful attempts caught on film. And it is a very, I don't want to say rough, it's a very harsh, no holds barred, marrow deep examination of suicide and the effects that it has on the people who survive and the people who witness it, and the kind of mindset that someone is in around the time that they decide to do that. There are a lot of really interesting and insightful interviews with friends and loved ones of these people. And it's kind of them trying to unravel their own confusion as to why someone would do this, as well as an examination of the kind of symbolic importance of doing it, particularly at the Golden Gate Bridge, which has an obscene amount of suicides every year. And it's beautiful, and it's like horrifying, and it's a gut punch, but it's really, really good. And I would say that it's recommended viewing for anyone who has had to, you know, deal with the fallout of a suicide in their own life.
Yeah, I will probably never watch this movie.
Just not feeling up for it.
No.
Okay.
Do you see them? Do you see them hit the water? Or
yes, sometimes.
Oh my
god.
Okay. It's brutal, and it's the type of thing where, you know, if they didn't confront it that way, I feel like it not only wouldn't have been as powerful, but it would have been a lot more exploitative. You know what I'm thinking? Like,
yeah, I see what you mean.
There is an honesty to it that is befitting of a subject that doesn't get talked about honestly a lot. And I have had to, you know, bury more friends than I'd care to mention. And it was, you'd think that it would feel exploitative, especially to someone who's had to deal with that. But it actually is it's a really interesting and powerful means of kind of embracing and coming to terms with like the facts of what happens. So, The Bridge by Eric Steele. I think it was 2006. I had seen it in theaters when it first came out, which was, I think it was like right before or right after a friend of mine had killed themselves. It was a very weird kind of fortuitous release. And, I decided to watch it again, and it holds up even, so many years removed. So yeah, check it out. It, is not for streaming anywhere, but you could probably buy it fairly cheaply. So yeah, The Bridge. And on that wonderful upward swinging note.
Yeah, just gonna buy that.
Woo! Rush out and see it. Feel good hit of the century. Anyway, yeah, let's wrap this thing up. So, guys, where can we be found online before the people tune in next week to listen to us talk about Oz the Great and Powerful? Nick?
Thefilmstage.com and twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
Danny?
Thefilmstage.com, thekingbulletin.com, and twitter.com/thekingbulletin.
And I can be found at thefilmstage.com as well as twitter.com/BrianJRowan. And on my personal blog, dearfilm.net, where you can go to find the link to see me on TV talking about movies. Terrifying. Terrifying stuff. yeah, it's a little weird seeing yourself in like a you know, professionally produced television show. It's unnerving. I don't know how celebrities do it. Something's wrong with those people. But yeah, so if you're interested in that, check it out. And if not, just tune in next week when we'll be talking about Oz the Great and Powerful. Radio. Live transmission. There are images from her childhood that we get that she has never been an ambitious or a worthwhile... Wow, I almost choked on something and I'm not even eating anything.